right then, we are recording right now. So this is now Friday, October 22, I believe. Is that correct? And this is chapter 12, slide 10. We're going to be nearly done with this and move on to chapter 13, which you should have at least one page of chapter 13. And that's how close we are to, I am to disaster. All right. So what? Yes? Someone asked for something? Oh, okay, never mind. All right, well, most enzymes are, in fact, bisubstrate. In other words, that when the Michaelis-Menten equation, the model, the mechanistic model that the Michaelis-Menten equation uses is, of course, E plus S yields reversibly, ES yielding P plus E. Now, what is the microscopic rate constant on top here? What is that called? What is it? What's the symbol for it? What's the symbol for it? We all know what it is. Just somebody shout it out. What? No, K1. What's down here? K minus 1. What's this over here? K2. All right. So, what is... what is this? Let's see here. Vmax over E. What? Vmax over ET. What is that? What's that equal to? Anybody remember? It's in the notes. Turnover number. Is that right? Turnover number. Which is equal to kcat, I believe, which sometimes equals K2. But notice what happens here, ladies and gentlemen. How many substrates are we dealing with here? What's this say? Just one. Just one. And you produce some sort of intermediate, and you get a product. And very simple. It's very powerful because it fits a lot of enzymes, but it doesn't fit every enzyme. And so these mechanisms are actually much more complicated. Most enzyme reactions are known as bisubstrate. A plus B yields P plus Q, or PX plus B equals P plus BX. That's a very common, these are two very common mechanisms you can see here. Here you got polypeptide and trypsin. Water enters into it, so it's actually a bisubstrate. You don't think of water as a substrate, but it is. It's a bisubstrate mechanism. You produce the two fragments, one with the carboxylic acid end with the amino end. Here you've got alcohol dehydrogenase. You've got ethanol and the NAD+, and you make aldehyde out of it and NADH. Oddly enough, this is what the people who drink alcohol, this is what happens to them as they're trying to metabolize it. Turns out it's that ethanol or acetaldehyde that gives you the buzz. The actual alcohol here actually doesn't have that much effect on the physiological response to drinking. This is the stuff that gives you the buzz, is the ethanol, the aldehyde version of it. The body can pretty much... You are constantly drinking small amounts of ethanol, whether you know it or not. I mean, there's microscopic amounts here, hither, thither, and yon in various drinks and stuff, and it just can't be helped. The body readily deals with it, but when you begin to drink it in a large excess, that's when you have trouble. All right, let's go ahead here. So when we have these bisubstrate reactions, what does the mechanism look like? When you have these bisubstrate reactions, what does the mechanism look like? And we can see here a series of possible mechanisms. Single displacement, double displacement. The majority of the reactions have been single displacement. That the single displacement, it focuses, you know, on the relationship between the reactants and the products. So here with the single displacements, all the reactants are in place before you produce any products. Double displacement, you have an alternative between reactant and product alternating. So here's the single displacement ordered by substrate. That means the A comes on board and binds to the enzyme. This does not have to be a covalent bonding. It can be some sort of non-covalent forces that are involved here. Then B comes in. You end up having this enzyme AB complex that once that B gets in position, both B and A and B are simultaneously changed by the action of the mechanism of the enzyme. And then you get the P is released and then the Q is released. In that order. In that order. It has to be A, then B, releasing P, then Q, ordered by substrate. This one here is single. This is called random by substrate. And here you see where you have the free enzyme. And either the B or the A can bind first. In the top line, the A binds first, then the B to get the EAB. But in the bottom line, the B binds first, then the A binds first. But the ultimate idea here is that it eventually makes that EAB intermediate, that once those two are in position, the A and the B are in position, then the enzyme can act on them simultaneously, produce the PQ. But again, in this case, the release is in fact not in any particular order. You could either release P first or Q first. And that is called the random by substrate. Both of these are more realistic enzyme mechanisms than anything that you're going to find with Lineweaver-Burk plots, the simple mechanisms you find from Michaelis Menten. And lastly, of course, you have the double displacement, also known as the ping pong by substrate. Now, oddly enough, notice I put here this little thing, ping pong. Ping pong turns out to be the trademarked name for what sport? Table tennis. But because it's for educational use, they haven't sued. But I, just for fun, put a little copyright there. So, anyway, ping pong mechanism. You can see here, this is interesting. We got the free enzyme, the A binds. Then you have the AE. The A then acts on the enzyme to change the very nature of the enzyme. Perhaps a phosphate group or other group is attached covalently to the enzyme. And you move from having just an enzyme that is just E to an enzyme that now is F. It's been slightly permanently modified. That once that F, once the P leaves, you have a free enzyme that's modified. F, it's not like E. Then B reactant comes in, binds with the FB, becomes EQ, Q leaves, and you now have the free enzyme. You can understand why they call it the ping pong mechanism. These are three mechanisms that are much more realistic than what you would suspect to, more realistic. It's kind of fun to think about how that works and to realize, oh, that's actually how it is. Now, we are not going to go into all these have been derivized. All these have been treated to the same mathematical rigor that this mechanism has gone through. And I've dealt with that in graduate school, and it's an algebraic nightmare dealing with all these microscopic rate constants that you got here. K1, K-1, then you got your K2, K-2, K, you know, you got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It just becomes a nightmare. And you can see, I've seen pictures of the original publications, and these, they were doing these in the 20s and 30s, actually, the algebra. And it's just pages and pages of these huge numbers of constants being multiplied and divided. And at any rate, so it was interesting to see. At the end of the day, honestly, though, most of the rate equations and most of the rate equations, the V0 equations, ended up looking very, very similar to the original Michaelis-Menten equation. So it is what it is. All right, so now, one of the most powerful and important effects that occur in kinetics is the fact that enzymes can be controlled. Sometimes they're controlled indirectly using allosteric modifiers, as our paradigm hemoglobin molecule suggested. If you recall, hemoglobin as a molecule actually has, let's see here, 5 allosteric modifiers. 5 allosteric modifiers. The first and most prominent one, of course, is oxygen. What are the other 4? What was it? Chlorine. What was it? Actually, carbon dioxide. You're right. Carbon dioxide. And then what? Hydrogen ion. Hydrogen ion. And What's that one little, what's that one molecule that's a sugar? BPG. Those four modifiers, those are allosteric modifiers. Well, their behavior kinetically somewhat follows this, but this is actually something more direct. This is what's known as an enzyme inhibition. Those allosteric modifiers were modifying the behavior, but not necessarily inhibiting the function of hemoglobin. And so what you've got here is an example of that. Enzymes may be inhibited reversibly or irreversibly. The kind of inhibition we're talking about here is reversible. And you can see that in the mechanism that I'm going to show you here. Irreversible inhibitors may bind at the active site or at some other site, but that binding is temporary. That's why it's reversible. That's why it's reversible. That's why you sometimes have to take drugs over a long period of time. In other words, you take an antibiotic and the binding to the particular enzyme that's being inhibited on the surface of the bacteria, that is reversible. And so as the antibiotic concentration drops because of the natural clearance by the kidneys and other organs, then that inhibition is released and the bacteria can grow again. So you end up having to take several doses to keep the level at a high level. Enzymes may also be inhibited by an irreversible manner. Well, there you go. In this case, penicillin is an irreversible suicide inhibitor. So my comment about the antibiotic for penicillin was, in fact, not correct. So it's that thing binds to the enzyme mechanism, and it's done. And so that enzyme is no longer usable. All right, so what happens is this. Let's take a look at this particular example that they show in the textbook. And this is where you got succinate using a succinate dehydrogenase going to fumarate. What pathway is that? Citric acid cycle. Exactly correct. Succinate going to fumarate. Citric acid cycle. And so succinate dehydrogenase. And you've got malonate. Malonate, of course, turns out that if you have this same reaction and you add malonate to it, in other words, that this is going along, you add malonate, then suddenly there is no reaction. You can't even get any fumarate to be made. So something's going on with that malonate that interacts with the succinate dehydrogenase to prevent the production of fumarate. How do we describe that? Well, this is called competitive inhibition. It's competitive inhibition because of how it interacts with the enzyme or the enzyme substrate. Here you see a situation where you've got this. Again, we go back to the simple Michaelis-Menten the mechanism that was used to describe the Michaelis-Menten equation. And you've got a situation here. We've got the enzyme plus substrate yields the enzyme substrate and the product and enzyme. A competitive inhibitor is at I that interrelates with the enzyme reversibly to produce an EI. An EI in the presence of S produces no reaction. No reaction. So notice here you get an inhibition constant, an inhibition rate constant, because that binding of the I to the E is reversible and is based on the law of mass action. And so can have some value that helps you understand how tightly it binds to the free enzyme. But notice, the inhibitor is acting on the free enzyme. So it's acting for the same binding site as the substrate. So the I and the S are acting at the same binding site as the substrate. They're acting together. Now, what happens is, if you take this and you create a mathematical model like the Michaelis-Menten equation is, you get a new variation of the Michaelis-Menten equation called V0 is equal to Vmax S all over alpha Km plus S. You can also create a Lineweaver-Burk plot or a Lineweaver-Burk linear equation rearranging this, where 1 over V0 is equal to alpha Km over Vmax, 1 over S, 1 over Vmax. So, then the alpha term is this 1 over I over KI. Concentration of I over KI. I'm not going to ask you to derive it. This is not that. It's not a part of this particular class. But interestingly enough, it has a characteristic effect on the Lineweaver-Burk plot as you plot this data. So you see here where the flattest, the least sloped of the Lineweaver-Burk plots invariably have no inhibitor with it. The alpha equals 1. In other words, that the I all over KI is 0. That means there's no inhibitor here. And so, but as you add, if you arbitrarily and capriciously just say alpha is 2 and plug that into this value or over here, you get a situation where you have a series of lines that are increasingly steep, but notice they always cross at what? 1 over Vmax. Why do they always cross 1 over Vmax? Well, look at the alpha. Is that alpha term multiplying 1 over Vmax? No. So the 1 over Vmax, the B term, is always constant. So the 1 over Vmax is right there, whereas that term, again, is the dependent variable is 1 over V0, and it's 1 over S. So you can immediately see the type of sloping here, and you need to connect that type of slope with that that phrase. This kind of slope, these kind of graphs, plotted Lineweaver-Burk, is called what? This is what? Competitive. And you on your homework are going to have to do some of these calculations to obtain this stuff. And we'll do that, I think, on Monday, I hope. I'll pass out some practice questions, and we may do them on Monday. So come with a calculator on Monday if you don't come already. So then, let's take a look at this. Oh, I want to go back here. I got to go back to Union. Okay. You see this thing right here. Notice this is, you've got the original, that far line right here. This far line right here, that's the unmodified Lineweaver-Burk plot. That's, of course, called 1 over Km. Negative 1 over Km. So this is negative 1 all over Km. That's that thing right there. These others that are shown here have been modified by the presence of that inhibitor. And your textbook calls those values KMAPP, KM apparent. In other words, KM apparent is a KM that's been modified by some sort of inhibitor. KM apparent means that there is that enzyme has been modified by some sort of inhibitor. In this case, we know KM apparent should have the value of alpha KM. Alpha KM. KM apparent is equal to alpha KM. Let's take a look at the example that they show here. I've taken this directly. I've copied this directly from the text, so you shouldn't have any trouble with this. You can read in the text about it. Sample calculation 12.1. How to calculate KI. Notice KM apparent. Now notice how I sometimes write KM apparent. I can't write KM apparent with the app above because I don't have a sophisticated typographic program. So I write it KM apparent like that. It's the same thing. Right? So KM apparent. Enzyme has a KM of 8 micromolar in the absence of a competitive inhibitor and KM apparent of 12 micromolar. Now again, the KM has to have the same unit as the substrate concentration. KMs have the same units as the substrate concentration. Notice, this independent variable is 1 over, what is it? S. And the substrate concentration can be a variety of things. It could be millimolar. It could be micromolar. It could be molar. I don't know. But whatever it is, notice you're extracting the KM value out of it. Is that correct? That's where you get it from, right? Say yes. Yes. Therefore, the KM has to have the same units. The KM has to have the same units. All right. Doom. All right. So, back up the truck. There we go. So, KM, that means KM is 8 micromolar absence of a competitor, 12 micromolar presence of 3 micromolar of the inhibitor. It's handy if everything is in the same. It's handy if it's in the same units, but the concentration of the inhibitor and the concentration of the substrate do not have to be in the same unit. First, calculate the alpha of KM alpha when KM equals that and KM apparent. So KM apparent equals alpha KM. Alpha is KM over KM. 12 micromolar over 8 micromolar. Alpha is equal to 1.5. Now notice what happens to the units in this case. They cancel out. Well then. Now is that going to be the case here? Well yes, because it turns out that the KI will have the same units as the concentration of the I. The KI has the same concentrations as the I. Thank you very much. So we have, so alpha is equal to 1.25. So we rearrange this, blah, blah, blah. And so we end up with having KI is equal to 3 micromolar. Where did I get that number from? Original problem. All over 1.5 minus 1. Where did I get that from? Well, 1.5 is the alpha. I plug in that. And I end up with KI being 6 micromolar. It doesn't have to be. Many times the inhibitor is like in millimolar, but the substrate concentration is in micromolar. So, remember this. You'll get to do it for homework and for tests. Tests. Yes, indeed. Be prepared. Any questions about this process? It's fairly straightforward, isn't it? This stuff is not rocket science. Honestly, it's not. But there's a lot of it. That's the only problem. Now, there's something also known as uncompetitive inhibition. And that is, that acts to reduce the amount of enzyme substrate that produces product. Notice, where does the inhibitor, in this mechanism, where does the inhibitor act? Where does the inhibitor act? Yeah, on the enzyme substrate combination, not just merely on the enzyme. So the enzyme and substrate can combine to form that enzyme substrate, but that's where the inhibitor begins to attack. It produces its ESI complex, and the ESI complex goes through no reaction. They've done the mathematics on it to produce the adapted or the altered Michaelis-Menten equation, and you can see here where the alpha now prime, they call it alpha prime because it's the We call that because to differentiate it between the original, the other K, we call this K prime I. That means this is an alpha prime. And notice how this works out to where apparently the alpha now is acting on the Y intercept, but is it acting on the slope? Is there any alpha prime value acting on the slope? No. So, if the alpha prime is not acting on the slope, guess what happens? The slopes do not change. If you have lines in which the slopes don't change, they're what? Parallel. But notice what is changing. Alpha prime, that is, the y-intercepts are changing. So the alpha prime over Vmax is what that. Then you have something now known as, and I don't have a good equation, I don't have a good example of it, example problem, but you have a Vmax apparent. So a Vmax apparent is the same thing, is similar to Vmax, a KM apparent. It's a Vmax that's been altered by the presence of an inhibitor. And you would do the same mathematics as you would do on the other thing. The slope, notice, the slope is KM Vmax. There's no alpha in either one of these. So you can readily figure out what Vmax is. Multiply that or set it against that Vmax there and find out what the alpha prime is and find out what the KI is or whatever in each of these problems. Again, parallel lines, what's it called? Uncompetitive, thank you very much. Last but not least is called mixed or non-competitive inhibition. Well, you know, you act on the free enzyme, you act on the enzyme substrate, and what other possible combination is there? Well, you act on both. That's what this is. Mixed inhibition or non-competitive. Oh, what did I just do here? Do I have any comments right here at all? Yeah. Well, yeah. I didn't write anything yet. So, there is not much to say about this. So, I'm just going to say it verbally. Here you can see where you now have the inhibitor, the same inhibitor, can act either on the free enzyme or the enzyme substrate. That if you act on the free enzyme, you get one rate constant, Ki, inhibitor rate constant. If you act on the enzyme substrate, you get a second, K prime I. Either one of these, of course, are producing no reactions. In this case, you now have a Michaelis-Menten equation in which there's two alphas involved, the alpha for the Ki and the alpha prime for the alpha for the K prime inhibitor. And so you end up having this situation where both the slope and the y-intercept are affected. The slope and the y-intercept are affected. And so you have the situation here where you've got changing Vmaxes and changing Kms. And so you get a Km apparent and Vmax apparent that all can behave. There is what's known as an ideal non-competitive or mixed inhibition reaction. There's an ideal one. This is one, and this never happens in real life. This is a mathematical perfection thing. And that's where all three lines meet at the intercept. Km apparent here. 1 over minus 1 over Km. This is what they call an ideal mixed. So that essentially what happens is there's one of these, and I'm not sure which one, it's probably the alpha, is given a value that allows these things to all meet right here. So this is an unusual one. These mixed ones typically intersect at a location other than the line here. All right, so that's the three kinds. Okay, so what three kinds are there? Let's quickly review. First kind we talked about was called what? Competitive. The next one was called uncompetitive. And the last one was called mixed or non-competitive. See, the mixed is better. I mean, what is non-competitive inhibitor? I mean, they're just trying to make a joke. Remember, like the southern blot, then you had the northern blot, then you had the western blot. Well, here you had the competitive, the uncompetitive, and then you had the non-competitive. Well, if it's non-competitive, it wouldn't be working at this at all. It just makes no sense. It's best if it says mixed. But I can tell you, well, never mind. They're going to try to fool you by saying non-competitive. Don't be fooled. All right, so control of enzyme activity, ladies and gentlemen. There are two forms of control here, enzyme availability and enzyme amount. Now, the enzyme amount is a combination of two things, the amount that is synthesized minus degradation. If you synthesize something, the body automatically has a process to do what? Degrade it. Okay? You can get diseases that are caused by poor synthesis or poor degradation. It doesn't matter. If it's either one of those is not working properly, you're going to have trouble. So the net amount is the net amount from the amount of synthesized minus degradation. That's the enzyme amount. Enzyme activity. Allosteric effectors is one of the most common ways of doing it. These are small molecules that bind temporarily to the enzyme. They do not require other enzymes to bind them. They're simply based on mass action. Higher values means there's going to be more stuck to the enzyme, and the enzyme is going to be under greater control. The other kind is a covalent modification. Covalent modification makes a covalent bond. That means covalent bonds are required enzymes to make them. So covalent modification means that you've got a series of enzymes that add to and remove a small molecule from the enzyme. Adding or subtracting a small molecule from that or small unit from that enzyme either turns it on or turns it off. And matter of fact, these kinds of things can happen simultaneously. You have enzyme A, enzyme B. Both get phosphorylated. Enzyme B is turned on, enzyme A is turned off by the same phosphorylation process. You'll see that coming up. So allosteric effectors, for example, ATCase reaction, and that's where this is carbamoyl phosphate. Carbamoyl phosphate. Where have I seen carbamoyl phosphate before? Let me think. What cycle have we seen it? Urea cycle, that's right. Urea, I just met a cycle named urea. No? Really kind of flat, I know. What song was that from? West Side Story, yes. And who is it supposed to be? Maria. That's right. How do you solve a problem like urea? All right, so you got this. So what happens is there's a lot of allosteric effectors that alter this behavior. If you notice, here, you've got the purple line or the middle line is no allosteric effectors whatsoever. No allosteric effectors whatsoever. Here you've got a system here, the CTP, you've got the line shifted. Oh, look at this. Notice what kind of shape is that? Is this is sigmoidal? It apparently there's some sort of cooperativity going on here. But notice with the presence of high levels of CTP, which is the ultimate product in all this, this will come back and act on the enzyme to slow this thing down. As you can see, because it shifts it to the right. ATP, however, high levels of ATP cause it to shift to the left, which increases its rate at any given concentration of aspartate. Allosteric effectors, because these things are not permanently bound to this enzyme, they're temporarily bound, but they like it's like a governor. It slows it down, speeds it up, slows it down. The more that's there, the more it's slowed down. The less it's there, the more it's speeded up. In this particular case, this is called feedback inhibition. You're familiar with that term probably from high school biology. Product binds at a location other than the active site. And so binding is non-covalent and distorts the active site. So typically, you're not acting on the actual active site. These allosteric effectors are not inhibitors in the classic sense that we talked about here. They're acting on sites other than the active site. Now comes an important one here. We're going to spend a little bit of time on this one. I don't know if we can get it done in 7 minutes or not. This one is a prime example of covalent modification. Covalent modification. Phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. One of the most common and powerful forms of covalent modification is the addition and subtraction of phosphate from an enzyme. Typically, the phosphate's adding to a serine somewhere on the molecule, not at the active site, not in the active site, but somewhere else on the molecule, always plenty of serines. You're going to distort temporarily, or not temporarily, but distort the active site, slows it down, speeds it up, whatever. Other times, the phosphate's added to a tyrosine, another important control mechanism, especially for development. Most common attacks serine, threonine, or tyrosine. Serine and threonine typically. The tyrosine is almost its own class. The enzyme that puts the phosphate on another molecule is called a kinase. I'm sure you've heard that before. The enzyme that removes the phosphate is called a phosphatase. These kinases and phosphatases work as a team. It's like a good cop, bad cop kind of situation. The kinases and phosphatases themselves are heavily regulated. Sometimes allosterically, many times covalently. Here you've got a situation where you've got this is the model, the protein kinase. You've got an enzyme that's inactive. That means it's got its hydroxy, one of the serine hydroxy groups, or other types of groups is available. The kinase puts a phosphate on it. It becomes active. The term active and inactive can be reversed. You can have an enzyme that's active when it's not phosphorylated and becomes deactivated when it gets phosphated. So don't be fooled by this inactive and active. That inactive and active can be interchanged readily. The protein phosphatase here is the thing that removes the phosphate and either turns on the enzyme by removing it or turns off the enzyme by removing the phosphate. Glycogen phosphorylase control. glycogen phosphorylase. Unfortunately, we've not gone through this thing, what glycogen phosphorylase does, but it is a paradigm of allosteric and covalent control. Let's see here. Do I have an equation there? I think I do, don't I? Let's see here. Yeah, I'm not going to rewrite it. Here it is. So, glycogen, of course, is a polymer of what monomer? Glycogen, a polymer of what monomer? Glucose. Okay? And the glucose is the linear form are held together by what glycosidic bond? Alpha 1 to 4. The branches are alpha 1 to 6. The bond that you cannot digest because of the cellulistic bond is alpha 1 to... No. It's beta, yeah. It's beta 1 to 4, isn't it? At any rate. Okay, so you make your glycogen, a number of glycogen, you get a phosphate. The glycogen phosphorylase breaks off one of the glycogen, one of the glucoses, and makes glucose 1-phosphate. Glucose 1-phosphate cannot be used by most things. There's an immediate enzyme that is an mutase or isomerase that converts it into a glucose 6, and that can be dumped into the glycolytic pathway. But nevertheless, this is the enzyme we're talking about, the enzyme that breaks down glycogen into glucose particles. Extremely important. For those of you who have not had breakfast, this is what's going on in your body right now, in your liver and muscle tissue. Now, glycogen phosphorylase has a variety of forms. I want you to note here, glycogen phosphorylase B typically is in the inactive form. It's in the T form, the inactive form. You can phosphorylate it, and it can still remain inactive, but it's called phosphorylase A. So phosphorylase can either be not phosphated or phosphated. Okay? It can also be in this form. You can be unphosphorylated but active. That's this form. So phosphorylase B means not phosphate. Phosphorylase A means phosphated. Let me review that again. Phosphorylase A, does that have a phosphate on it or not? Phosphorylase B, does it have a phosphate on it or not? No. But you can have an inactive form that is not phosphated, that's active, and you can have a phosphorylated form that's actually inactivated. As you can see here, notice the width of the arrows. That is not a mistake. That when the phosphorylase is in its not phosphated form, the predominant species in that pool of molecules is in the inactive form. So in this ratio here, with it not being phosphorylated, it predominates in the inactive form. But guess what high levels of AMP does in the cell? What do high levels of AMP do? It shifts covalently that T form into the what? Into the R form, which is active, even though it's not phosphated. The phosphated form, however, typically, if you notice the arrow, the predominant form in the phosphated form is the what? Active form. However, the active form can be shifted to the inactive by allosteric effectors if there's high levels of what? Glucose. Phosphated, active, turned off by high levels of glucose. Inactive, not phosphated, turned on by high levels of AMP. But can this ratio between these two forms be shifted by things other than AMP? Yes. ATP and or glucose 6-phosphate. High levels of these can shift it in the active form. Before you leave, I got to ask you this question. Does this make metabolic sense? If you have high levels of phosphorylase A, you're making plenty of glucose 1-phosphate. Is that right? If you already have high levels of glucose in the body, do you need to be breaking up glycogen to make more glucose? No, so high levels of glucose act on the active phosphorylase to shut it off. It's saying, I know you're phosphorylated, shut it off. So how do we get phosphorylated on there, and how does it get dephosphorylated on there? You can see here, this is in fact the direct caption from this figure. Please, I urge you to read that caption more than once. The model of how this happens is replayed over and over again in enzyme systems we're never even going to cover here in this class. Thank you very much. We'll see you on Monday.
Okay, this one's for Gabby. High above the chimney top, that's where